The decade of progressive change. That's what a retired English teacher called the years 1967 to 77 when he taught in New Orleans. He says that was the perfect place for innovation.
Something new was happening in the schools. It didn't get a lot of attention because I think people would rather have a beer than fight.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll talk about creativity and chaos. We'll also hear how recruiters are getting busy and spend an academic minute with sourdough lessons. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. Charles Suhor always liked marching to the different drummer, and he has the jazz percussionist chops to prove it. Dr. Suhor is a New Orleans native, taught English in the city's schools, and in 1967 became English supervisor for the district. He later became deputy executive director of the National Council of Teachers of English until his retirement in 1997. In his latest book, he goes back to 1967, which he said was the beginning of a decade-long progressive revolution in education. Dr. Charles Suhor's book is called Creativity and Chaos, Reflections on a Decade of Progressive Change in Public Schools, 1967 to 1977. I asked why he took on this project.
Well, I was retired, and I wanted to record some things that I think had been insufficiently noticed. My first book in retirement was Jazz in New Orleans in the Post-War Years, because nobody had been writing about jazz at that time. Everybody was writing about the early years, but New Orleans was a center for jazz, even in the late 40s, early 50s. So I wanted to get that on the record, and I had been writing for Downbeat, so I had a wealth of materials to draw from. And I had the same impulse in writing about the progressive decade in New Orleans and the nation. Now, some have written about that, but I didn't think that they handled it with, I guess, with fairness or with thoroughness or something. But I had a story to tell, and I wanted to get it on record for better or worse. I don't know if it would be well-received, criticized, panned, or what, but my job is to get it out there and to tell my narrative and see what happens in the universe. So that's what my writing has been pretty much of my career.
What is it about those years, that time frame, 67 to 77, that made it what you call the progressive decade?
Well, I mean, those were the years of almost unraveling of the social fabric. You had the Vietnam War, protests against the war. You had assassinations of the Kennedys and Martin Luther King Jr. You had the drug culture arising with tune-in, tune-out, drop-out. You had rock and roll morphing into protest music and socially conscious music. It was a great era of change. Some would not use the word great, but it was upsetting. I mean, the 50s had been Ozzie and Harriet time, Beaver Cleaver. We thought after the war that this was a time of peace and relaxation, and that came to an end early to mid-60s, and it was really a time of chaos. I was teaching at high school then, and the parents did not know what to make of it, you know. They said, what is going on here? Is this our America? And it was our America in important ways, because we were a nation that began a revolution, and things had gotten so quiet, complacent, standardized, and unfortunately self-satisfied in the 50s socially, that was the context for the progressive changes in the schools. Now, the schools couldn't escape this because that was in the air, you know. The schools wanted to be taking the lead, but once it got started, the schools picked it up, and it became quite a difficult time, but quite a creative time.
And how did you take that, all that revolution, all that change, and put it into an English, you're an English teacher, of course, into an English curriculum? How did that how did that change manifest in that?
Well, I didn't set out to create a revolution, but in fact, English teaching was revolutionized. I guess I have to admit that. Because before that, for example, in the teaching of literature, the curriculum was what they called dead white guys, you know. And we brought in black literature. We brought in young adult literature. When I was a kid, young adult literature was Treasure Island, Little Women, and the Bobbsey Twins. Well, young adult literature brought mature themes into teen literature. That was a major change. We started teaching contemporary literature, live white guys, women, different concepts of not only what to teach, but how to teach it. So that was some of the changes. In the teaching of language and grammar, there was a huge chunk of research that was being done in the 50s, actually, that demonstrated that Black English, which came to be known as Ebonics, had its own internal structure, which was coherent. It wasn't a bad version of standard English. English, standard English, can be described in an orderly fashion, and so can Black English. So that the problem was not to denigrate Black English as a mess, but to show that Black English has its own valid structure, but it's not socially marketable for a kid who is graduating from high school and wants to get into the mainstream of American culture professionally. So that we had to get new ways, and we did invent new ways of teaching standard English grammar that would not criticize and denigrate the language of the home. That was huge. We didn't succeed in that, but it's still ongoing, although not too well. Also, new stuff showed up altogether. It was seen that the teaching of media was a part of the whole literary experience. A movie has a structure, a rhetoric of its own. It has its own devices that are parallel in some ways to literature, plot, theme, character. But in other ways, that it has its own structural aspects to it that were worthy of consideration and discussion and study. So that came a part of it. Film study, even looking at non-print media of artistic forms. For example, we could take a look at writing, at a picture rather, and the kids could look at a provocative picture, maybe an Escher sketch, and write something about it, you know? And in writing, writing had been the five-paragraph theme at best. Mostly it was carrying out the rules of grammar properly rather than expressing oneself. So in writing, there was much more attention to things that interested the student in self-expression rather than following rules that produced a neat little bloodless essay. And that was huge. Free writing, which could then be shaped into academic writing. Big, big difference. Books were written about this. Workshops were given on it. Then came the writing process instruction, in which students were given ways of thinking and talking about the topic so that they would be ready to write.
It's interesting you say that. I recently interviewed the author of a book that was called Why the Five-Paragraph Essay Must Die. So I guess that was something that was pretty standard for teachers at the time.
Yeah, I taught the five-paragraph essay when I was beginning teaching in the late 50s because it was one way of getting kids to write something orderly. But the trouble is they were writing something that nobody gave a damn about, you know. They were doing a formula rather than writing something that somebody had something to say about. So in the progressive era, the idea was to get the student to self-express in free writing and then shape that into a form that's essay-like in a traditional sense, in an academic sense, you might say.
Still to come, our conversation with Charles Suhor continues with a look at how these changes went over in the city of New Orleans. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got Got any questions or comments about the best of our knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to the Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett, and our guest today is Charles Suhoor, a retired lifelong English teacher and author of the new book, Creativity and Chaos, Reflections on a Decade of Progressive Change in Public Schools, 1967 to 1977. Dr. Suhoor began his career as an English teacher in New Orleans. I asked if being in that city at that time made instituting progressive change easier.
Good thing about teaching there was I could do innovations, both as a teacher and as a supervisor of English. And we didn't have a lot of organized opposition, as they do in many other places. If something new was happening in the schools, it didn't get a lot of attention because I think people would rather have a beer than fight, you know. So we were lucky to be able to bring in black literature and all kinds of new things in the curriculum during the decade of progressive change.
Were these changes, I mean, of course, you were an English teacher and that was your specialty, but did you notice these changes going on in other departments in schools like history or science?
Yeah, there were. The movement was cross-curriculum. I think that English was the most radical changes and the most visible ones, the most controversial ones. So we were having the most fun. and we were having taken the most flack. But again, in New Orleans, we just got through with a lot of this stuff because it's the city that can't forgotten. People weren't, at that time, looking to censor books, which they were doing elsewhere. So we got a lot of stuff going, and creatively, most of the literature stuff lasted. A lot of the other stuff didn't. Yeah, it was other subjects. I think the new math was a problem, like the new English was in some ways. But that wasn't my specialty, but I was part of a sort of a sympathetic progressive group that was working downtown as supervisors to make changes. Yeah, it was in other subjects too.
You mentioned testing. I'd like to get into that because you do talk in the book about standardized tests and how tests that originated from outside of the community really weren't very helpful for you.
Yeah, actually, I have a whole slew of problems with standardized testing, which goes back to the old norm reference tests, which compared the students who took the tests to a group that created the norm, that set the standard that they were compared against. This has been alleviated somewhat, but students were being compared against a norm group that consisted of middle-class students in suburban Chicago, you know. And so that was going to be a disadvantage to the non-middle-class students who were taking the tests, because the tests were also biased against minorities, against non-standard speakers, et cetera, so that the norm reference tests were a mess. They still have some norm reference tests in which students' knowledge of a specific area is tested. There still is the dangers of test bias against females, minorities, et cetera. Worst of all, it still tends to drive the curriculum and drive teaching. Because whatever those experts who decided what should be in the test put in the test is what teachers notice. And since they're on the line to improve scores, they tend to teach their tests. Now, creative teachers hate this. There are some teachers who need it. They're so bad that if you didn't have the testing system, they would teach nothing at all. You know, they would be reading a newspaper. But by and large, the teaching force is better than ever before, and they're just not given the leeway to invent or to color outside the lines being the test content and the content of the core curriculum where there is one.
How were these changes politicized at the time?
How were they politicized?
Yeah.
Well, I think the whole process is political to begin with. If you take political to mean favoring the status quo, which is the conservative establishment, the conservative establishment was in control, not necessarily intentionally, but by inheritance, of the curriculum. And the curriculum was then basically geared towards college entrance and middle-class and upper-middle-class kids. The curriculum became less of a learning program than a sorting process, where those who didn't meet those standards right away would be graded low, would be put into the Buzzard reading group rather than the Robbins reading group, and would be ultimately kicked out or dropped out or forced out of the process. Now, the progressive movement tried to take into account the fact that some students come from disadvantaged backgrounds, or the language habits or the learning habits or the economic problems or the nutrition problems work against their benefit, so that they try to compensate for that by looking at the learning styles of students from different classes, from different cultures, from different races. And that's why a lot of the changes came about in that time. The trouble is that most teachers, I should say most, were not in tune with that. So it was a huge training and learning process. Now, I was supervisor of English of K-12 in New Orleans, and so I got the allies on the English department heads to take the lead. And I would try to get English teachers into positions where they would be the ones who had student teachers, or they'd be the ones who'd be giving programs at conferences and conventions, or in-service programs. So gradually the culture was changed so that the progressives became normative and the traditionalists became unhappy minorities. And that's what my contribution was there. Nationally, I was active in the National Council of Teachers of English. Now, that's a progressive group, basically. But I would go there and talk about our programs. I would meet with other supervisors, and we would talk about each other's programs and try to cross-fertilize. I was writing articles for local and national journals about new methods and new content, so that I was an all-out crusader, you might say, for the progressive movement. And it was fun. It was an exciting time. And I worked a lot with students, got students on TV, got students on teachers' programs. It was great fun. And I had my little classroom at home where I would use my new methods to teach my own kids. I taught two or three of my kids how to read before kindergarten by using a progressive method. It was struggle, but it was creative struggle. One of the best times of my life, both domestically and professionally.
So where do we sit now? Have those progressive changes progressed and grown, or have we slipped back a bit?
Well, no. Around the mid-70s, there was a backlash of the progressive movement. Partly warranted, there were some abuses of progressivism. Teachers who just let anything happen and rewarded students for doing nothing in the name of progressivism. That wasn't what it was about, but it was what some teachers unthinkingly, lazily took it to be. And there were some teachers who didn't understand some of the methods, so they couldn't carry them out because they lacked the classroom teaching skills, or they didn't know how to do them without losing control of their discipline in the classroom. So there was a basics backlash, and I guess around 1975 or so, it got really big. The Back to Basics movement, along with the conservatism at the federal level, turned the tide, and my superintendent, Gene Dysart, who had been an initiator of the progressive movement when he first arrived in New Orleans, bought into the new method totally, the new backlash totally. And it was a terrible place to be, because I was part of the leadership, I became part of the opposition. Bad place to be when you're in the central office. So miraculously, almost, I got a job offer from NCTE, and I left at just the right time. Because our whole district, pretty much like the whole nation, went into what they call mastery learning, which is a building block way. Learn one little step, then take the next step, et cetera. And that's good for learning how to clean an M1 rifle. That's how they have to clean a rifle in the Army. But it's not good for helping kids to become better thinkers, to develop critical thinking, to help their discussion skills. That's the kind of thing that, A, is not testable under our technology, and B, I think there should be in there somewhere. But it's not a way to operate when you're dealing with complex skills. It's good for simple skills, but if we're not teaching simple skills, we're not doing our job.
Are they taking a look at the New Orleans school system now? The entire state of Louisiana has gone to a mainly charter school system. Do you think that has helped?
Well, the charter school system came well after the progressive movement and the basics backlash. But the jury is still out, but I'm not a fan. So after Katrina, New Orleans became ground zero for the charter movement because the system physically was devastated. The buildings were flooded, and the faculties had left town to go to Houston or Baton Rouge or somewhere else. And so there was a chance, some people said, to have a reform based on charter schools. Well, a charter school can be one that is progressively oriented, but in the climate of the basics backlash, they came out to be charter schools that had strict discipline, dress codes, traditional learning, grammar, all the stuff that was reactionary. So, and there's very little control over the curriculum because every charter school has its own homemade curriculum. You don't have a system-wide way of assessing things. Of course, they're very selective in who they take and keep in many of the charter schools, so that resurrects some of the old problems. It remains to be seen, I mean, where education is going to go. It'll take a huge, huge change in psychology of the country and in the educational establishment and in federal guidelines for the testing movement to be altered.
Again, the name of Dr. Charles Suhor's book is Creativity and Chaos, Reflections on a Decade of Progressive Change in Public Schools, 1967 to 1977. National Guard recruiters in some states say they're seeing a surge in interest from people, both students and older adults, hoping to join. Some applicants say they're inspired by the Guard's role in responding to the COVID-19 pandemic, while others are looking to make some money in a tough economy. Jennifer Brookland reports for the American Homefront Project.
In a Winston-Salem warehouse, North Carolina Army National Guard soldiers with the 130th Maneuver Enhancement Brigade have been assigned a different task than usual: inspecting eggs for a local food bank. Around the country, the National Guard has been activated for COVID duty. Guardsmen are running mobile testing teams in Florida, sewing face masks in Indiana, even planting cantaloupe, peppers, and squash on a nonprofit farm in North Carolina, whose regular volunteers have been forced to stay home. North Carolina National Guard spokesman Lieutenant Colonel Matthew DeVivo says it's a unique and historic mission.
We've been working a lot with the food banks across the state, the large food banks in Raleigh and Winston-Salem, and our soldiers and airmen have been helping them plant seeds in the farmland that they use to cultivate vegetables because the volunteers just aren't there. And our guardsmen have been candling eggs, looking with a high light onto an egg to see if there's cracks and if it's still serviceable to be given out at food banks. Every single guardsman we've spoken to feel like it's so rewarding to be doing these different types of missions that not necessarily they ever thought they'd be doing.
In Denver, Colorado guardsmen rolled carts down the corridors of a Quality Inn, providing contactless meal delivery to members of the city's homeless population now residing there. Their stepped-up role in the community might be one reason for what the guard says is a big jump in the number of people applying to join. Lieutenant Colonel George O'Neill is in charge of recruiting for the Colorado Army National Guard.
Close to the 1st of April, we started to see an increase in calls with more traffic to our website and a lot more interest on social media.
More than 46,800 National Guard soldiers and airmen have been mobilized across all 50 states, the District of Columbia, Puerto Rico, Guam, and the U.S. Virgin Islands, a number that far outstrips the post-9/11 response and is ticking up toward the activation numbers that followed Hurricane Katrina. With so many guardsmen headed out, potential recruits keep coming in. National Guard Bureau data show recruiting leads for the Army National Guard are up 90% compared to last year. O'Neill says layoffs and furloughs in the job market could be playing a role.
We obviously ask our, applicants why they're interested in joining the National Guard, and some of them are more frank with us than others, that, they want to help out and get involved, or some are, unemployed and negatively affected by the virus.
In California, recruiters who normally meet with 2 to 5 people each day are fielding requests from 10 to 15, according to Master Sergeant Alberto Gastelum, Recruiting and Retention Section Chief for San Diego County. But he says the boost is coming from people who just want to be part of the team.
the exposure that we're currently having with everything that we're doing here in California and nationwide has made a big impact. It's an advertisement that they can see what their soldiers normally do. So all the citizens here, the residents in our state, are jumping on board to say, I want to be part of that. I want to be able to help.
Jake Stanish is one of those people. He is a public school teacher who moved from Boston to California weeks before the pandemic shut everything down, including his hopes of substitute teaching. So Stanish has a lot of time on his hands. And, he says, seeing the guards' response to this public health crisis was inspirational.
There's so much need. Even if it's just helping, like here in San Diego, the guard is helping at food banks and to provide, you know, PPE from the federal government. There's just a lot going on that the guard can help with.
For Stanish, it was the motivation he needed to apply to join. And now he has his application documents in order and his physical scheduled. Stanish says whether it's deploying to Afghanistan or at a neighborhood food bank, he's eager to help wherever he's needed. I'm Jennifer Brookland in Durham, North Carolina.
You never know where you're going to find a life lesson. It could be sourdough. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
We have lots to learn from sourdough bread. I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Eric Pallant, professor of environmental science and sustainability, explains why.
Every day, half of all Americans eat a sandwich, consuming 325 million slices of bread. The majority of what we eat is pale, white bread mass-produced by incomprehensibly large machines and leavened in what factory managers call the no-time dough system. To turn flour and water into a finished loaf in just a couple of hours, food scientists add dough conditioners, elasticizers, thick fats, surfactants, antimicrobial preservatives, emulsifiers, oxidizing agents, and sugars. A typical loaf of supermarket bread, white as snow, soft as a marshmallow, and smelling vaguely of chemicals, typically contains at least 20 and often more than 30 ingredients. For 6,000 years, since breads were first baked in the Fertile Crescent until the end of the 19th century, the staff of life was made by hand from only four ingredients. Flour, water, salt, and a sourdough culture of wild yeast and bacteria. Workers who built the Egyptian pyramids received the bulk of their calories from sourdough bread. Ancient Rome imported wheat from across its vast empire to turn into loaves it distributed to Roman citizens. Survival through the Middle Ages depended upon preparation of sourdough loaves baked in communal ovens. Even the very thought, and certainly the aroma, of the crisp crust and chewy interior of a freshly baked sourdough bread will cause most humans to salivate in anticipation. Very few slices taken from a colorful plastic bag invoke the same response. In contrast to the wild species of yeast and bacteria that slowly leaven a sourdough loaf, commercial yeast inflates bread with speed, efficiency, and profit, but without much taste. Making sourdough bread in your own kitchen, something I teach students to do every year, is one small way to reclaim our historical connection to a food that has sustained us for millennia, and then eat something incredibly delicious.
That was Eric Pallant of Allegheny College. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. And you can find us on Twitter at @TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org. ¶¶